it.
In other instances, however, women told me that the violent objections of their husbands disappeared when they finally made up their own minds and went to work. Had they magnified their husbands' objections to evade decision themselves? Husbands I have interviewed in the same context were sometimes surprised to find it a relief to be no longer the only sun and moon in their wives' world. They were the object of less nagging and fewer insatiable demands, and they no longer had to feel guilt over their wives' discontent. As one man put it, not only is the financial burden lighter, and frankly that is a relief, but the whole burden of living seems easier since Margaret went to work. There are husbands, however, whose resistance is not so easily dispelled. The husband who is unable to bear his wife saying no to the feminine mystique often has been seduced himself by the infantile fantasy of having an ever-present mother, or is trying to relive that fantasy through his children. It is difficult for a woman to tell such a husband that she is not his mother and that their children will be better off without her constant attention. Perhaps if she becomes more truly herself and refuses to act out his fantasy any longer, he will suddenly wake up and see her again. And then again, perhaps he will look for another mother. Another hazard a woman faces on her way out of the housewife trap is the hostility of other housewives. Just as the man evading growth in his own work resents his wife's growth, so women who are living vicariously through their husbands and children resent the woman who has a life of her own. At dinner parties, the nursery school affair, the PTA open house, a woman who is more than just a housewife can expect a few barbs from her suburban neighbors. She no longer has the time for idle gossip over endless cups of coffee in the breakfast nook. She can no longer share with other wives that cozy, we're all in the same boat illusion. Her very presence rocks that boat. And she can expect her home, her husband, and her children to be scrutinized with more than the usual curiosity for the slightest sign of a problem. This kind of hostility, however, sometimes masks a secret envy. The most hostile of the happy housewives may be the first to ask her neighbor with the new career for advice about moving on herself. For the woman who moves on, there is always a sense of loss that accompanies change. Old friends, familiar and reassuring routines lost, the new ones not yet clear. It is so much easier for a woman to say yes to the feminine mystique and not risk the pains of moving on. That the will to make the effort, ambition, is as necessary as ability itself if she is going to move out of the housewife trap. Ambition, like career, has been made a dirty word by the feminine mystique. When Polly Weaver, College and Careers editor of Mademoiselle, surveyed 400 women in 1956 on the subject of ambition and competition, most of them had guilty feelings about being ambitious. They tried, in Miss Weaver's words, to make it uplifting, not worldly and selfish like eating. We were surprised at the number of women who drive themselves from morning to night for a job or the community or church, for example, but don't want a nickel's worth out of it for themselves. They don't want money, social position, power, influence, recognition. Are these women fooling themselves? The mystique would have women renounce ambition for themselves. Marriage and motherhood is the end. After that, women are supposed to be ambitious only for their husbands and their children. Many women who indeed fool themselves push husband and children to fulfill that unadmitted ambition of their own. There were, however, many frankly ambitious women among those who responded to the Mademoiselle survey, and they did not seem to suffer from it. The ambitious women who answered our questionnaire had few regrets over sacrifices of sweet old friends, family picnics, and time for reading books no one talks about. They got more than they gave up, they said, and cited new friends, the larger world they move in, the great spurts of growth they had when they worked with the brilliant and the talented, and most of all the satisfaction of working at full steam, putt-putting along like a pressure cooker. In fact, some happy, ambitious women make the people around them happy. Their husbands, children, their colleagues. A very ambitious woman is not happy either, leaving her prestige entirely to her husband's success. To the active, ambitious woman, ambition is the thread that runs through her life from beginning to end, holding it together and enabling her to think of her life as a work of art instead of a collection of fragments. For the women I interviewed who had suffered and solved the problem that has no name, to fulfill an ambition of their own, long buried or brand new, to work at top capacity, to have a sense of achievement, was like finding a missing piece in the puzzle of their lives. The money they earned often made life easier for the whole family, but none of them pretended this was the only reason they worked, or the main thing they got out of it.
That sense of being complete and fully a part of the world, no longer an island, part of the mainland, had come back.
They knew that it did not come from the work alone, but from the whole, their marriage, homes, children, work, their changing, growing links with the community. They were once again human beings, not just housewives. Such women are the lucky ones. Some may have been driven to that ambition by childhood rejection, by an ugly duckling adolescence, by unhappiness in marriage, by divorce or widowhood. It is both an irony and an indictment of the feminine mystique that it often forced the unhappy ones, the ugly ducklings, to find themselves, while girls who fitted the image became adjusted, happy housewives and have never found out who they are. But to say that frustration can be good for a girl would be to miss the point. Such frustration should not have to be the price of identity for a woman, nor is it in itself the key. The mystique has kept both pretty girls and ugly ones, who might have written poems like Edith Sitwell, from discovering their own gifts. Kept happy wives and unhappy ones, who might have found themselves, as Ruth Benedict did in Anthropology, from even discovering their own field. And suddenly, the final piece of the puzzle fits into place. There was one thing without which even the most frustrated seldom found their way out of the trap, and regardless of childhood experience, regardless of luck in marriage, there was one thing that produced frustration in all women of this time who tried to adjust to the housewife image. There was one thing shared by all I encountered who finally found their own way. The key to the trap is, of course, education. The feminine mystique has made higher education for women seem suspect, unnecessary, and even dangerous. But I think that education, and only education, has saved, and can continue to save, American women from the greater dangers of the feminine mystique.
In 1957, when I was asked to do an alumni questionnaire of my own college classmates 15 years after their graduation from Smith, I seized on the chance, thinking that I could disprove the growing belief that education made women masculine, hampered their sexual fulfillment, caused unnecessary conflicts and frustrations. I discovered that the critics were half right. Education was dangerous and frustrating, but only when women did not use it.
Of the 200 women who answered that questionnaire in 1957, 89% were housewives. They had lived through all the possible frustrations that education can cause in housewives. But when they were asked, "What difficulties have you found in working out your role as a woman? What are the chief satisfactions and frustrations of your life today? How have you changed inside? How do you feel about getting older? What do you wish you had done differently?" It was discovered that the real problems as women were not caused by their education. In general, they regretted only one thing, that they had not taken their education seriously enough, that they had not planned to put it to serious use. Of the 97% of these women who married, usually about 3 years after college, only 3% had been divorced. Of 20% who had been interested in another man since marriage, most did nothing about it. As mothers, 86% planned their children's births and enjoyed their pregnancies. 70% breastfed their babies from 1 to 9 months. They had more children than their mothers, averaged 2.94, but only 10% had ever felt martyred as mothers. Though 99% reported that sex was only one factor among many in their lives, they neither felt over and done with sexually, nor were they just beginning to feel the sexual satisfaction of being a woman. Some 85% reported that sex gets better with the years, but they also found it less important than it used to be. They shared life with their husbands as fully as one can with another human being, but 75% admitted readily that they could not share all of it. Most of them, 60%, could not honestly say in reporting their main occupation as homemaker that they found it totally fulfilling. They only spent an average of 4 hours a day on housework, and they did not enjoy it. It was perhaps true that their education made them frustrated in their role as housewives. Educated before the era of the feminine mystique, many of them had faced a sharp break from their emerging identity in that housewife role, and yet most of these women continued to grow within the framework of suburban housewifery. Perhaps because of the autonomy, the sense of purpose, the commitment to larger values which their education had given them. Some 79% had found some way to pursue the goals that education had given them, for the most part within the physical confines of their communities. The old Helen Hokanson caricatures notwithstanding, their assumption of community responsibility was, in general, an act of maturity, a commitment that used a renewed strength of self. For these women, community activity almost always had the stamp of innovation and individuality rather than the stamp of conformity, status-seeking, or escape. They set up cooperative nursery schools in suburbs where none existed. They started teenage canteens and libraries in schools where Johnny wasn't reading because, quite simply, there were no good books. They innovated new educational programs that finally became a part of the curriculum. One was personally instrumental in getting 13,000 signatures for a popular referendum to get politics out of the school system. One publicly spoke out for desegregation of schools in the South. One got white children to attend a de facto segregated school in the North. One pushed an appropriation for mental health clinics through a Western state legislature. One set up museum art programs for school children in each of three cities she had lived in since marriage. Others started or led suburban choral groups, civic theaters, foreign policy study groups. 30% were active in local party politics, from the committee level to the state assembly. Over 90% reported that they read the newspaper thoroughly every day and voted regularly. They evidently never watched a daytime television program and seemed almost never to play bridge or read women's magazines. Of the 15 to 300 books apiece they had read in that 1 year, half were not bestsellers. Facing 40, most of these women could report, quite frankly, that their hair was graying and their skin looked faded and tired, and yet say, with not much regret for lost youth, "I have a growing sense of self-realization, inner serenity and strength. I have become more my real self." "How do you visualize your life after your children are grown?" they were asked on a questionnaire. Most of them, 60%, had concrete plans for work or study. They planned to finish their education finally, for many who had no career ambitions in college had them now. A few had reached the depths of bitterness, the verge of disillusion and despair, trying to live just as housewives. A few confessed longingly that running my house and raising four children does not really use my education or the ability I once seemed to have. If only it were possible to combine motherhood and a career. And the most bitter were those who said, "Never have found out what kind of person I am. I wasted college trying to find myself in social life. I wish now that I had gone into something deeply enough to have a creative life of my own." But most did know, now, who they were and what they wanted to do, and 80% regretted not having planned seriously to use their education in professional work. Passive appreciation and even active participation in community affairs would no longer be enough when their children were a little older. Many women reported that they were planning to teach. Fortunately for them, the great need for teachers gave them a chance to get back in the stream. Others anticipated years of further study before they would be qualified in their chosen fields. These 200 Smith graduates have their counterparts in women all over the country, women of intelligence and ability, fighting their way out of the housewife trap, or never really trapped at all because of their education. But these graduates of 1942 were among the last American women educated before the feminine mystique. In another questionnaire answered by almost 10,000 graduates of Mount Holyoke in 1962, its 125th anniversary year, one sees the effect of the mystique on women educated in the last two decades. The Mount Holyoke alumni showed a similar high marriage and low divorce rate, 2% overall. But before 1942, most were married at 25 or older. After 1942, the marriage age showed a dramatic drop, and the percentage having four or more children showed a dramatic rise. Before 1942, two-thirds or more of the graduates went on to further study. That proportion has steadily declined. Few in recent classes have won advanced degrees in the arts, sciences, law, medicine, education, compared to the 40% in 1937. A drastically decreasing number also seemed to share the larger vistas of national or international commitment. Participation in local political clubs had dropped to 12% by the class of 1952. From 1942 on, few graduates had any professional affiliation. Half of all the Mount Holyoke alumni had worked at one time but were no longer working, primarily because they had chosen the role of housewife. Some had returned to work, both to supplement income and because they liked to work. But in the classes from 1942 on, where most of the women were now housewives, nearly half did not intend to return to work. The declining area of commitment to the world outside the home from 1942 on is a clear indication of the effect of the feminine mystique on educated women. Having seen the desperate emptiness, the trapped feeling of many young women
who were educated under the mystique to be just a housewife, I realized the significance of my classmates' experience.
Because of their education, many of them were able to combine serious commitments of their own with marriage and family. They could participate in community activities that required intelligence and responsibility and move on with a few years' preparation into professional social work or teaching. They could get jobs as substitute teachers or part-time social workers to finance the courses needed for certification. They had often grown to the point where they did not want to return to the fields they had worked in after college, and they could even get into a new field with the core of autonomy that their education had given them. But what of the young women today who have never had a taste of higher education, who quit college to marry or mark time in their classrooms waiting for the right man? What will they be at 40? Housewives in every suburban city are seeking more education today, as if a course, any course, will give them the identity they are groping toward. But the courses they take and the courses they are offered are seldom intended for real use in society. Even more than the education she evaded at 18 in sexual fantasy, the education a woman can get at 40 is permeated, contaminated, diluted by the feminine mystique. Courses in golf, bridge, rug hooking, gourmet cooking, sewing are intended, I suppose, for real use by women who stay in the housewife trap. The so-called intellectual courses offered in the usual adult education centers, art appreciation, ceramics, short story writing, conversational French, great books, astronomy in the space age, are intended only as self-enrichment. The study, the effort, even the homework that imply a long-term commitment are not expected of the housewife. Actually, many women who take these courses desperately need serious education, but if they have never had a taste of it, they do not know how or where to look for it, nor do they even understand that so many adult education courses are unsatisfactory simply because they are not serious. The dimension of reality essential even to self-enrichment is barred, almost by definition, in a course specifically designed for housewives. This is true even where the institution giving the course has the highest standards. Recently, Radcliffe announced an Institute for Executives' Wives, to be followed presumably by an Institute for Scientists' Wives, or an Institute for Artists' Wives, or an Institute for College Professors' Wives. The executive's wife, or the scientist's wife, at 35 or 40, whose children are all at school, is hardly going to be helped to the new identity she needs by learning to take a more detailed, vicarious share of her husband's world. What she needs is training for creative work of her own. Among the women I interviewed, education was the key to the problem that has no name, only when it was part of a new life plan and meant for serious use in society, amateur or professional. They were able to find such education only in the regular colleges and universities.
Despite the wishful thinking engendered by the feminine mystique in girls and in their educators, an education evaded at 18 or 21 is insuperably harder to obtain at 31 or 38 or 41 by a woman who has a husband and three or four children and a home.
She faces, in the college or university, the prejudices created by the feminine mystique. No matter how brief her absence from the academic proving ground, she will have to demonstrate her seriousness of purpose over and over again to be readmitted. She must then compete with the teeming hordes of children she and others like her have overproduced in this era. It is not easy for a grown woman to sit through courses geared to teenagers, to be treated as a teenager again, to have to prove that she deserves to be taken as seriously as a teenager. A woman has to exercise great ingenuity, endure many rebuffs and disappointments to find an education that fits her need, and also make it fit her other commitments as wife and mother. One woman I interviewed, who had never gone to college, decided after psychotherapy to take two courses a year at a nearby university which, fortunately, had an evening school. At first she had no idea where it was leading her, but after 2 years, she decided to major in history and prepare to teach it in high school. She maintained a good record, even though she was often impatient with the slow pace and the busy work. But at least studying with some purpose made her feel better than when she used to read mystery stories or magazines at the playground. Above all, it was leading to something real for the future. But at the rate of two courses a year, which then cost $420 and 2 evenings a week in class, it would have taken her 10 years to get a BA. The second year, money was scarce, and she could only take one course. She could not apply for a student loan unless she went full-time, which she could not do until her youngest was in first grade. In spite of it all, she stuck it out that way for 4 years, noticing that more and more of the other housewives in her classes dropped out because of money or because the whole thing was going to take too long. Then, with her youngest in first grade, she became a full-time student in the regular college, where the pace was even slower because the students were less serious. She couldn't endure the thought of all the years ahead to get an MA, which she would need to teach high school history in that state. So she switched to an education major. She certainly would not have continued this expensive, torturous education if by now she had not had a clear life plan to use it, a plan that required it. Committed to elementary teaching, she was able to get a government loan for part of her full-time tuition, now exceeding $1,000 a year, and in another 2 years, she will be finished. Even against such enormous obstacles, more and more women with virtually no help from society and with belated and begrudging encouragement from educators themselves are going back to school to get the education they need. Their determination betrays women's underestimated human strength and their urgent need to use it. But only the strongest, after nearly 20 years of the feminine mystique, can move on by themselves. For this is not just the private problem of each individual woman. There are implications of the feminine mystique that must be faced on a national scale. The problem that has no name, which is simply the fact that American women are kept from growing to their full human capacities, is taking a far greater toll on the physical and mental health of our country than any known disease. Consider the high incidence of emotional breakdown of women in the role crises of their 20s and 30s. The alcoholism and suicides in their 40s and 50s, the housewives' monopolization of all doctors' time. Consider the prevalence of teenage marriages, the growing rate of illegitimate pregnancies, and even more seriously, the pathology of mother-child symbiosis. Consider the alarming passivity of American teenagers. If we continue to produce millions of young mothers who stop their growth in education short of identity, without a strong core of human values to pass on to their children, we are committing, quite simply, genocide, starting with the mass burial of American women and ending with the progressive dehumanization of their sons and daughters. These problems cannot be solved by medicine or even by psychotherapy. We need a drastic reshaping of the cultural image of femininity that will permit women to reach maturity, identity, completeness of self, without conflict with sexual fulfillment. A massive attempt must be made by educators and parents, and ministers, magazine editors, manipulators, guidance counselors, to stop the early marriage movement, stop girls from growing up wanting to be just a housewife, stop it by insisting, with the same attention from childhood on, that parents and educators give to boys, that girls develop the resources of self, goals that will permit them to find their own identity. It is, of course, no easier for an educator to say no to the feminine mystique than for an individual girl or woman. Even the most advanced of educators seriously concerned with the desperate need of housewives with leftover lives on their hands hesitate to buck the tide of early marriage. They have been browbeaten by the oracles of popularized psychoanalysis and still tremble with the guilt at the thought of interfering with a woman's sexual fulfillment. The rearguard argument offered by the oracles, who are, in some cases, right on college campuses themselves, is that since the primary road to identity for a woman is marriage and motherhood, serious educational interests or commitments which may cause conflicts in her role as wife and mother should be postponed until the childbearing years are over. Such a warning was made in 1962 by a psychiatric consultant to Yale University, which had been considering admitting women as undergraduates for the same serious education it gives men. Many young women, if not the majority, seem to be incapable of dealing with future long-range intellectual interests until they have proceeded through the more basic phases of their own healthy growth as women. To be well done, the mother's job in training children and shaping the life of her family should draw on all a woman's resources, emotional and intellectual, and upon all her skills. The better her training, the better chance she will have to do the job well, provided that emotional roadblocks do not stand in her way. Provided, that is, that she has established a good basis for the development of adult femininity and that during the course of her higher education, she is not subjected to pressures which adversely affect that development. To urge upon her conflicting goals, to stress that a career and a profession in the man's world should be the first consideration in planning her life, can adversely affect the full development of her identity. Of all the social freedoms won by her grandmothers, she prizes first the freedom to be a healthy, fulfilled woman, and she wants to be free of guilt and conflict about it. This means that though jobs are often possible within the framework of marriage, careers rarely are. The fact remains that the girl who wastes and wastes she does her college years without acquiring serious interests and wastes her early job years marking time until she finds a man gambles with the possibilities for an identity of her own as well as the possibilities for sexual fulfillment and wholly affirmed motherhood. The educators who encourage a woman to postpone larger interests until her children are grown make it virtually impossible for her ever to acquire them. It is not that easy for a woman who has defined herself wholly as wife and mother for 10 or 15 or 20 years to find new identity at 35 or 40 or 50. The ones who are able to do it are, quite frankly, the ones who made serious commitments to their earlier education, the ones who wanted and once worked at careers, the ones who bring to marriage and motherhood a sense of their own identity, not those who somehow hope to acquire it later on. A recent study of 50 women college graduates in an eastern suburban city, the year after the oldest child had left home, showed that, with very few exceptions, the only women who had any interest to pursue in work and community activities or in the arts had acquired them in college. The ones who lacked such interests were not acquiring them now. They slept late in their empty nests and looked forward only to death. Educators at every women's college, at every university, junior college, and community college must see to it that women make a lifetime commitment, call it a life plan, a vocation, a life purpose, if that dirty word career has too many celibate connotations, to a field of thought, to work of serious importance to society. They must expect the girl as well as the boy to take some field seriously enough to want to pursue it for life. This does not mean abandoning liberal education for women in favor of how-to vocational courses. Liberal education, as it is given at the best of colleges and universities, not only trains the mind, but provides an ineradicable core of human values. But liberal education must be planned for serious use, not merely dilettantism or passive appreciation. As boys at Harvard or Yale or Columbia or Chicago go on from the liberal arts corps to study architecture, medicine, law, science, girls must be encouraged to go on, to make a life plan. It has been shown that girls with this kind of a commitment are less eager to rush into early marriage, less panicky about finding a man, more responsible for their sexual behavior. Most of them marry, of course, but on a much more mature basis. Their marriages, then, are not an escape, but a commitment shared by two people that becomes part of their commitment to themselves and society. If, in fact, girls are educated to make such commitments, the question of sex and when they marry will lose its overwhelming importance. It is the fact that women have no identity of their own that makes sex, love, marriage, and children seem the only and essential facts of women's life. In the face of the feminine mystique with its powerful hidden deterrence, educators must realize that they cannot inspire young women to commit themselves seriously to their education without taking some extraordinary measures. The few so far attempted barely come to grips with the problem. Mary Bunting's new Institute for Independent Study at Radcliffe is fine for women who already know what they want to do, who have pursued their studies to the PhD, or are already active in the arts and merely need some respite from motherhood to get back in the mainstream. Even more important, the presence of these women on the campus, women who have babies and husbands and who are still deeply committed to their own work, will undoubtedly help dispel the image of the celibate career woman and fire some of those Radcliffe sophomores out of the climate of unexpectation that permits them to meet the nation's highest standard of educational excellence, to use it later only in marriage and motherhood. This is what Mary Bunting had in mind, and it can be done elsewhere, in even simpler ways. It would pay every college and university that wants to encourage women to take education seriously to recruit for their faculties all the women they can find who have combined marriage and motherhood with the life of the mind. Even if it means concessions for pregnancies or breaking the old rule about hiring the wife of the male associate professor who has her own perfectly respectable MA or PhD. As for the unmarried woman scholars, they must no longer be treated like lepers. The simple truth is that they have taken their existence seriously and have fulfilled their human potential. They might well be and often are envied by women who live the very image of opulent togetherness but have forfeited themselves. Women, as well as men, who are rooted in human work, are rooted in life. It is essential, above all, for educators themselves to say no to the feminine mystique and face the fact that the only point in educating women is to educate them to the limit of their ability. Women do not need courses in marriage and the family to marry and raise families. They do not need courses in homemaking to make homes. But they must study science, to discover in science, study the thought of the past, to create new thought, study society, to pioneer in society. Educators must also give up these one-thing-at-a-time compromises, that separate layering of education, sex, marriage, motherhood, interest for the last third of life, will not solve the role crisis. Women must be educated to a new integration of roles. The more they are encouraged to make that new life plan, integrating a serious lifelong commitment to society with marriage and motherhood, the less conflicts and unnecessary frustrations they will feel as wives and mothers, and the less their daughters will make mistaken choices for lack of a full image of woman's identity. I could see this in investigating college girls' rush to early marriage. The few who were not in such a desperate hurry to get a man and who committed themselves to serious long-range interests, evidently not worried that they would thereby lose their femininity, almost all had mothers or other private images of women who were committed to some serious purpose. My mother happens to be a teacher. My best friend's mother is a doctor. She always seems so busy and happy. Education itself can help provide that new image and the spark in girls to create their own as soon as it stops compromising and temporizing with the old image of woman's role. For women as well as men, education is and must be the matrix of human evolution. If today American women are finally breaking out of the housewife trap in search of new identity, it is quite simply because so many women have had a taste of higher education, unfinished, unfocused, but still powerful enough to force them on. For that last and most important battle can be fought in the mind and spirit of woman herself. Even without a private image, many girls in America who have been educated simply as people were given a strong enough sense of their human possibility to carry them past the old femininity, past that search for security and man's love, to find a new self. A Swarthmore graduate entering her internship told me that at first, as she felt herself getting more and more independent in college, she worried a lot about having dates and getting married, wanted to latch on to a boy. I tried to beat myself down to be feminine, then I got interested in what I was doing and stopped worrying, she said. It's as if you've made some kind of shift. You begin to feel your competence in doing things, like a baby learning to walk. Your mind begins to expand. You find your own field, and it's a wonderful thing. The love of doing the work and the feeling there's something there and you can trust it. It's worth the unhappiness. They say a man has to suffer to grow. Maybe something like that has to happen to women too. You begin not to be afraid to be yourself. Drastic steps must now be taken to re-educate the women who were deluded or cheated by the feminine mystique. Many of the women I interviewed who felt trapped as housewives have in the last few years started to move out of the trap. But there are as many others who are sinking back again because they did not find out in time what they wanted to do or because they were not able to find a way to do it. In almost every case, it took too much time, too much money, using existing educational facilities. Few housewives can afford full-time study. Even if colleges admit them on a part-time basis, and many will not, few women can endure the slow-motion pace of usual undergraduate college education stretched over 10 or more years. Some institutions are now willing to gamble on housewives, but will they be as willing when the flood of their college-bound offspring reaches its full height? The pilot programs that have been started at Sarah Lawrence and the University of Minnesota begin to show the way, but they do not face the time-money problem, which is, for so many women, the insurmountable one. What is needed now is a national educational program, similar to the GI Bill, for women who seriously want to continue or resume their education and who are willing to commit themselves to its use in a profession. The bill would provide properly qualified women with tuition fees, plus an additional subsidy to defray other expenses, books, travel, even if necessary, some household help. Such a measure would cost far less than the GI Bill. It would permit mothers to use existing educational facilities on a part-time basis and carry on individual study and research projects at home during the years when regular classroom attendance is impossible. The whole concept of women's education would be re-geared from four-year college to a life plan under which a woman could continue her education without conflict with her marriage, her husband, and her children. The GIs, matured by war, needed education to find their identity in society. In no mood for time-wasting, they astonished their teachers and themselves by their scholastic performance. Women who have matured during the housewife moratorium can be counted on for similar performance. their desperate need for education and the desperate need of this nation for the untapped reserves of women's intelligence in all the professions justify these emergency measures. For those women who did not go to college or quit too soon, for those who are no longer interested in their former field or who never took their education seriously, I would suggest, first of all, an intensive, concentrated re-immersion in, quite simply, the humanities. Not abridgments and selections like the usual freshman or sophomore survey, but an intensive study like the educational experiments attempted by the Bell Telephone Company or the Ford Foundation for young executives who had conformed so completely to the role of organization man that they were not capable of the initiative and vision required in top executive ranks. For women, this could be done by a national program along the lines of the Danish Folk High School movement, which would first bring the housewife back into the mainstream of thought with a concentrated 6-week summer course, a sort of intellectual shock therapy. She would be subsidized so that she could leave home and go to a resident college, which is not otherwise used during the summer. Or she could go to a metropolitan center on an equally intensive basis, 5 days a week for 6 or 8 weeks during the summer, with a day camp provided for the children. Assume that this educational shock treatment awakens able women to purposes requiring the equivalent of a 4-year college program for further professional training. That college program could be completed in 4 years or less, without full-time classroom attendance, by a combination of these summer institutes, plus prescribed reading, papers, and projects that could be done during the winter at home. Courses taken on television or at local community colleges and universities on an extension basis could be combined with tutorial conferences at mid-year or every month. The courses would be taken for credit, and the customary degrees would be earned. Some system of equivalence would have to be worked out, not to give a woman credit for work that does not meet requirements, but to give her credit for truly serious work, even if it is done at times, places, and in ways that violate conventional academic standards. A number of universities automatically bar housewives by barring part-time undergraduate or graduate work. Perhaps they have been burned by dilettantes, but part-time college work, graduate or undergraduate, geared to a serious plan, is the only kind of education that can prevent a housewife from becoming a dilettante. It is the only way a woman with husband and children can get or continue an education. It could also be the most practical arrangement from the university's point of view. With their facilities already overtaxed by population pressures, universities and women alike would benefit from a study program that does not require regular classroom attendance. While it makes a great deal of sense for the University of Minnesota to work out its excellent plan for women's continuing education in terms of the regular university facilities, such a plan will not help the woman who must begin her education all over again to find out what she wants to do. But existing facilities in any institution can be used to fill in the gaps once a woman is underway on her life plan. Colleges and universities also need a new life plan. To become lifetime institutions for their students, offer them guidance, take care of their records, and keep track of their advanced work or refresher courses, no matter where they are taken. How much greater that allegiance and financial support from their alumni if, instead of the tea parties to raise funds and a sentimental reunion every 5th June, a woman could look to her college for continuing education and guidance. Barnard alumni can and do come back and take free any course at any time if they meet the qualifications for it. All colleges could conduct summer institutes to keep alumni abreast of developments in their fields during the years of young motherhood. They could accept part-time students and offer extension courses for the housewife who cannot attend classes regularly. They could advise her on reading programs, papers, or projects that could be done at home. They could also work out a system whereby projects done by their alumni in education, mental health, sociology, political science, in their own communities, could be counted as equivalent credits toward a degree. Instead of collecting dimes, let women volunteers serve supervised professional apprenticeships and collect the credits that are recognized in lieu of pay for medical interns. Similarly, when a woman has taken courses at a number of different institutions, perhaps due to her husband's geographical itinerary, and has earned her community credits from agency, hospital, library, or laboratory, her college of origin, or some national center set up by several colleges, could give her the orals, the comprehensives, and the appropriate examinations for a degree. The concept of continuing education is already a reality for men in many fields. Why not for women? not education for careers instead of motherhood, not education for temporary careers before motherhood, not education to make them better wives and mothers, but an education they will use as full members of society. But how many American women really want to do more with their lives? The cynic asks. A fantastic number of New Jersey housewives responded to an offer of intensive retraining in mathematics for former college women willing to commit themselves to becoming mathematics teachers. In January 1962, a simple news story in the New York Times announced that Sarah Lawrence's Esther Rauschenbusch had obtained a grant to help mature women finish their education or work for graduate degrees on a part-time basis that could be fitted in with their obligations as mothers. The response literally put the small Sarah Lawrence switchboard out of commission. Within 24 hours, Mrs. Rauschenbusch had taken over 100 telephone calls. It was like bank night, the operator said, as if they had to get in there right away or they might miss the chance. Interviewing the women who applied for the program, Mrs. Rauschenbusch, like Virginia Senders at Minnesota, was convinced of the reality of their need. They were not neurotically rejecting their husbands and children. They did not need psychotherapy, but they did need more education in a hurry and in a form they could get without neglecting their husbands and families. Education and re-education of American women for a serious purpose cannot be affected by one or two far-sighted institutions. It must be accomplished on a much wider scale. And no one serves this end who repeats, even for expedience or tact, the clichés of the feminine mystique. It is quite wrong to say, as some of the leading women educators are saying today, that women must, of course, use their education, but not, heaven forbid, in careers that will compete with men. When women take their education and their abilities seriously and put them to use, ultimately they have to compete with men. It is better for a woman to compete impersonally in society, as men do, than to compete for dominance in her own home with her husband, compete with her neighbors for empty status, and so smother her son that he cannot compete at all. Consider this recent news item about America's latest occupational therapy for the pent-up feminine need to compete. It is a typical weekday in Dallas. Daddy is at work. Baby is having his morning nap. In an adjoining room, brother, age 3, is riding a new rocking horse, and sis, 5, is watching TV cartoons. And mommy? Mommy is just a few feet away, crouching over the foul line on lane 53, her hip twisted sharply to the left to steer the blue-white marble ball into the strike pocket between 1 and 3 pins. Mommy is bowling. Whether in Dallas or Cleveland or Albuquerque or Spokane, energetic housewives have dropped dustcloth and vacuum and hauled the children off to the new alleys, where full-time nurses stand ready to babysit in the fully equipped nurseries. Said the manager of Albuquerque's Bolodrome, "Where else can a woman compete after she gets married? They need competition just like men do. It sure beats going home to do the dishes." It is perhaps beside the point to remark that bowling alleys and supermarkets have nursery facilities, while schools and colleges and scientific laboratories and government offices do not. But it is very much to the point to say that if an able American woman does not use her human energy and ability in some meaningful pursuit, which necessarily means competition, for there is competition in every serious pursuit of our society, she will fritter away her energy in neurotic symptoms or unproductive exercise or destructive love. It also is time to stop giving lip service to the idea that there are no battles left to be fought for women in America, that women's rights have already been won. It is ridiculous to tell girls to keep quiet when they enter a new field, or an old one, so the men will not notice they are there. In almost every professional field, in business and in the arts and sciences, women are still treated as second-class citizens. It would be a great service to tell girls who plan to work in society to expect this subtle, uncomfortable discrimination. Tell them not to be quiet and hope it will go away, but fight it. A girl should not expect special privileges because of her sex, but neither should she adjust to prejudice and discrimination. She must learn to compete then, not as a woman, but as a human being. Not until a great many women move out of the fringes into the mainstream will society itself provide the arrangements for their new life plan. But every girl who manages to stick it out through law school or medical school, who finishes her MA or PhD and goes on to use it, helps others move on. Every woman who fights the remaining barriers to full equality, which are masked by the feminine mystique, makes it easier for the next woman. The very existence of the President's Commission on the Status of Women under Eleanor Roosevelt's leadership creates a climate where it is possible to recognize and do something about discrimination against women in terms not only of pay, but of the subtle barriers to opportunity. Even in politics, Women must make their contribution not as housewives, but as citizens. It is perhaps a step in the right direction when a woman protests nuclear testing under the banner of Women Strike for Peace. But why does the professional illustrator who heads the movement say she is just a housewife, and her followers insist that once the testing stops, they will stay happily at home with their children? Even in the city strongholds of the big political party machines, women can, and are beginning to, change the insidious unwritten laws which let them do the political housework while the men make the decisions. When enough women make life plans geared to their real abilities and speak out for maternity leaves or even maternity sabbaticals, professionally run nurseries, and the other changes in the rules that may be necessary, they will not have to sacrifice the right to honorable competition and contribution any more than they will have to sacrifice marriage and motherhood. It is wrong to keep spelling out unnecessary choices that make women unconsciously resist either commitment or motherhood, and that hold back recognition of the needed social changes. It is not a question of women having their cake and eating it too. A woman is handicapped by her sex and handicapped society either by slavishly copying the pattern of man's advance in the professions or by refusing to compete with man at all. But with the vision to make a new life plan of her own, she can fulfill a commitment to profession and politics and to marriage and motherhood with equal seriousness. Women who have done this, in spite of the dire warnings of the feminine mystique, are in a sense mutations. The image of what the American woman can be. When they did not or could not work full-time for a living, they spent part-time hours on work which truly interested them. Because time was of the essence, they often skipped the time-wasting, self-serving details of both housewifery and professional busy work. Whether they knew it or not, they were following a life plan. They had their babies before or after internship, between fellowships. If good full-time help was not available in the children's early years, they gave up their jobs and took a part-time post that may not have paid handsomely, but kept them moving ahead in their profession. The teachers innovated in PTA and substituted. The doctors took clinical or research jobs close to home. The editors and writers started freelancing. Even if the money they made was not needed for groceries or household help, and usually it was, they earned tangible proof of their ability to contribute. They did not consider themselves lucky to be housewives. They competed in society. They knew that marriage and motherhood are an essential part of life, but not the whole of it. These mutations suffered and surmounted the cultural discontinuity in role conditioning, the role crisis, and the identity crisis. They had problems, of course, tough ones, juggling their pregnancies, finding nurses and housekeepers, having to give up good assignments when their husbands were transferred. They also had to take a lot of hostility from other women, and many had to live with the active resentment of their husbands. And because of the mystique, many suffered unnecessary pains of guilt. It took and still takes extraordinary strength of purpose for women to pursue their own life plans when society does not expect it of them. However, unlike the trapped housewives, whose problems multiply with the years, these women solved their problems and moved on. They resisted the mass persuasions and manipulations and did not give up their own, often painful, values for the comforts of conformity. They did not retreat into privatism, but met the challenges of the real world. And they know quite surely now who they are. They were doing, perhaps without seeing it clearly, what every man and woman must do now to keep up with the increasingly explosive pace of history and find or keep individual identity in our mass society. The identity crisis in men and women cannot be solved by one generation for the next. In our rapidly changing society, it must be faced continually, solved only to be faced again in the span of a single lifetime. A life plan must be open to change, as new possibilities open in society and in oneself. No woman in America today who starts her search for identity can be sure where it will take her. No woman starts that search today without struggle, conflict, and taking her courage in her hands. But the women I met who were moving on that unknown road did not regret the pains, the efforts, the risks. In the light of women's long battle for emancipation, the recent sexual counter-revolution in America has been perhaps a final crisis, a strange breath-holding interval before the larva breaks out of the shell into maturity, a moratorium during which many millions of women put themselves on ice and stopped growing. They say that one day science will be able to make the human body live longer by freezing its growth. American women lately have been living much longer than men, walking through their leftover lives like living dead women, Perhaps men may live longer in America when women carry more of the burden of the battle with the world instead of being a burden themselves. I think their wasted energy will continue to be destructive to their husbands, to their children, and to themselves until it is used in their own battle with the world. But when women, as well as men, emerge from biological living to realize their human selves, those leftover halves of life may become their years of greatest fulfillment. Then the split in the image will be healed, and daughters will not face that jumping-off point at 21 or 41. When their mother's fulfillment makes girls sure they want to become women, they will not have to beat themselves down to be feminine. They can stretch and stretch until their own efforts will tell them who they are. They will not need the regard of boy or man to feel alive. And when women do not need to live through their husbands and children, men will not fear the love and strength of women, nor need another's weakness to prove their own masculinity. They can finally see each other as they are, and this may be the next step in human evolution. Who knows what women can be when they are finally free to become themselves? Who knows what women's intelligence will contribute when it can be nourished without denying love? Who knows of the possibilities of love when men and women share not only children, home, and garden, not only the fulfillment of their biological roles, but the responsibilities and passions of the work that creates the human future and the full human knowledge of who they are? It has barely begun, the search of women for themselves. But the time is at hand when the voices of the feminine mystique can no longer drown out the inner voice that is driving women on to become complete. Epilogue. When the feminine mystique was at the printers and my last child was in school all day, I decided I would go back to school myself and get my PhD. Armed with my publisher's announcement, a copy of my summa cum laude undergraduate degree, and 20 years back graduate record, and the New World Foundation report of the educational project I had dreamed up and run in Rockland County, I went to see the head of the social psychology department at Columbia. He was very tolerant and kind, but surely at 42, after all those undisciplined years as a housewife, I must understand that I wouldn't be able to meet the rigors of full-time graduate study for a PhD and the mastery of statistics that was required. "But I used statistics throughout the book," I pointed out. He looked blank. "Well, my dear," he said, "what do you want to bother your head getting a PhD for anyhow?" I began to get letters from other women who now saw through the feminine mystique, who wanted to stop doing their children's homework and start doing their own. They were also being told they really weren't capable of doing anything else now but making homemade strawberry jam or helping their children do fourth grade arithmetic. It wasn't enough just to take yourself seriously as a person. Society had to change somehow for women to make it as people. It wasn't possible to live any longer as just a housewife. But what other way was there to live? I remember getting stuck at that point, even when I was writing The Feminine Mystique. I had to write a last chapter, giving a solution to the problem that has no name, suggesting new patterns, a way out of the conflicts, whereby women could use their abilities fully in society and find their own existential human identity, sharing its action, decisions, and challenges, without at the same time renouncing home, children, love, their own sexuality. My mind went blank. You do have to say no to the old way before you can find the new yes you need. Giving a name to the problem that had no name was the necessary first step. But it wasn't enough. Personally, I couldn't operate as a suburban housewife any longer, even if I had wanted to. For one thing, I became a leper in my own suburb. As long as I only wrote occasional articles most people never read, the fact that I wrote during the hours when the children were in school was no more a stigma than, for instance, solitary morning drinking. But now that I was acting like a real writer, and even being interviewed on television, the sin was too public. It could not be condoned. Women in other suburbs were writing me letters as if I were Joan of Arc, but I practically had to flee my own crabgrass overgrown yard to keep from being burned at the stake. Although we had been fairly popular, my husband and I were suddenly no longer invited to our neighbors' dinner parties. My kids were kicked out of the carpool for art and dancing classes. The other mothers had a fit when I now called a cab when it was my turn instead of driving the children myself. We had to move back to the city, where the kids could do their own thing without my chauffeuring and where I could be with them at home during some of the hours I now spent commuting. I couldn't stand being a freak alone in the suburbs any longer. At first, that strange hostility in my book and later the movement seemed to elicit from some women amazed and puzzled me. Even in the beginning, there wasn't the hostility I had expected from men. Many men bought the feminine mystique for their wives and urged them to go back to school or to work. I realized soon enough that there were probably millions of women who had felt as I had, like a freak, absolutely alone, as a suburban housewife. But if you were afraid to face your real feelings about the husband and children you were presumably living for, then someone like me opening up the can of worms was a menace. I don't blame women for being scared. I was pretty scared myself. It isn't really possible to make a new pattern of life all by yourself. I've always dreaded being alone more than anything else. The anger I had not dared to face in myself during all the years I tried to play the helpless little housewife with my husband, and feeling more helpless the longer I played it, was beginning to erupt now, more and more violently. For fear of being alone, I almost lost my own self-respect, trying to hold on to a marriage that was based no longer on love, but on dependent hate. It was easier for me to start the women's movement, which was needed to change society, than to change my own personal life. It seemed time to start writing that second book, but I couldn't find any new patterns in society beyond the feminine mystique. I could find a few individual women knocking themselves out to meet good housekeeping standards, trying to raise Spockian children while working in a full-time job and feeling guilty about it, and conferences were being held about the availability of continuing education for women because all those aging full-time housewife mothers whose babies were now in college were beginning to be trouble, drinking, taking too many pills, committing suicide. Whole learned journals were devoted to the discussion of women and their options, the stages of women's lives. Women, we were told, could go to school, work a bit, get married, stay with the children 15 to 20 years, and then go back to school and work, no problem. No need for role conflicts. The women who were advancing this theory were among the exceptional few to reach top jobs because they somehow had not dropped out for 15 or 20 years. And these same women were advising the women flocking back to their continuing education programs that they couldn't really expect to get real jobs or professional training after 15 years at home. Ceramics or professional volunteer work, that was the realistic adjustment. Talk. That's all it was, talk. In 1965, the long-awaited report of the President's Commission on the Status of Women detailed the discriminatory wages women were earning, half the average for men, and the declining ratio of women in professional and executive jobs. The commission recommended that women be counseled to use their abilities in society and suggested that child care centers and other services be provided to enable women to combine motherhood and work. But Margaret Mead, in her introduction to the report, said, in effect, if women are all going to want to make big decisions and discoveries, who is going to stay home and bandage the child's knee or listen to the husband's troubles? No matter that, with her husband's help, and even before her child's knees were in school all day, she herself was making big anthropological discoveries and decisions. Perhaps women who have made it as exceptional women don't really identify with other women. For them, there are three classes of people, men, other women, and themselves. Their very status as exceptional women depends on keeping other women quiet and not rocking the boat. The President's Commission report was duly buried in bureaucratic file drawers. That summer of 1965, I got a third of the way through the book I wanted to write about going beyond the feminine mystique. By then I knew that there weren't any new patterns, only new problems that women weren't going to be able to solve unless society changed. And all the talk and the reports and the commission and the continuing education programs were only examples of tokenism, maybe even an attempt to block a real movement on the part of women themselves to change society. It seemed to me that something more than talk had to happen. The only thing that's changed so far is our own consciousness, I wrote, closing that second book, which I never finished, because the next sentence read, what we need is a political movement, a social movement, like that of the blacks. I had to take action. On the plane to Washington, pondering what to do, I saw a student reading a book, The First Step to Revolution is Consciousness, and it was like an omen. I went to Washington because a law had been passed, Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, banning sex discrimination in employment, along with race discrimination. The sex discrimination part had been tacked on as a joke and a delay in maneuver by a Southern congressman, Howard Smith of Virginia, At the first press conferences after the law went into effect, the administrator in charge of enforcing it joked about the ban on sex discrimination. It will give men equal opportunity to be Playboy bunnies, he said. In Washington, I found a seething underground of women in the government, the press, and the labor unions who felt powerless to stop the sabotage of this law that was supposed to break through the sex discrimination that pervaded every industry and profession, every factory, school, and office. Some of these women felt that I, as a now-known writer, could get the public's ear. One day, a cool young woman lawyer who worked for the agency that was not enforcing the law against sex discrimination carefully closed the door of her office.